Welcome to the History Slam podcast from ActiveHistory.ca. Here's your host, Sean Graham.
Thank you, Adam. Welcome to the History Slam, everybody. I am Sean Graham coming at you today nearly live. We are in Ottawa, Ontario. And a few weeks ago, I was actually in Prince Edward Island, and they're celebrating there the 150th anniversary of the Charlottetown Conference. And I went to the legislature and saw the video that they have, which is somewhat propagandist. But I went and I saw it, and I saw where they had the conference, the Charlottetown Conference in 1864. It's part of a larger celebration in Charlottetown right now. For the conference, they have a big thing by the waterfront with some musicians and a whole thing set up, which is pretty cool. And for those of you who are regular listeners, you might remember a few months ago when we had our Historical Figures reality show podcast, the man, the myth, the legend himself, Aaron Boys, shamelessly plugged something for a friend of his. And we've invited Aaron back. Welcome back to the show.
Always great to be here.
And we actually have his friend with us as well, Laurie Campbell, who is an actor and a writer who was part of the show What to Wear to the Birth of a Nation, which ran this summer. And she is here from Toronto, Ontario. Laurie, welcome to the podcast.
Well, thanks for having me, Sean.
Hey, my pleasure. And, you know, anything that we can do to support a friend of Aaron Boys, we'll definitely do on the show.
Excellent.
Yeah, I was really glad when I pitched this idea to Sean to get you on here, Laurie, that you were able to do this, because like he said, I threw out that shameless plug, and for you to actually talk about it now and let all the listeners know what it was that I was plugging is great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I really appreciate that shameless plug, Aaron.
Hey, my pleasure.
And I'm sure the people were just queued up at the door every night based off of it.
Yep, definitely. They're saying, oh, Aaron and Sean, we heard.
So the title of the show, I think, gives a bit of a hint as to what it was about, but just sort of walk us through What to Wear to the Birth of a Nation.
We selected the title. Obviously, you know, it has something to do with Confederation, but at the same time, it still leaves a little bit of room for questioning, definitely. And basically, myself and co-writer Rebecca Perron, we wrote two-act, 10-vignette play about the women, girls, and women of different classes leading up to Confederation. And so it wasn't just, you know, up to the PEI conference. It was, you know, a little bit before, a little bit after, and we were a bit ambiguous with the dates. So we jumped between different scenes. And each scene had two women in it.
So you're on stage the whole time playing a variety of characters.
Yeah. So it took, I found that it really took our audiences, we never really explained anywhere that it wasn't, you know, a typical play that had a plot, you know, just straight through, you know, nice happy ending. It really was just 10 separate scenes, and we kind of linked them together, but it took about into the second or third scene, you know, you could almost hear people afterwards, they were commenting saying, oh, I didn't really realize that you were playing different characters throughout. And so to kind of link that together, we had a really great costume designer and seamstress on hand. Her name was Rainey Wesselak, and she made us amazing costumes to really help that transition.
But how would you do that on stage? I mean, does the lights go down? Or, I mean, just walk us through the process of that, because,
yeah,
I mean, changing on stage, I'm sure, is not ideal.
It was tricky. It became a lot about the wardrobe, and we put our heads together through a night of wine, Rebecca and I, and we just sat and we listened to a bunch of music by PEI female artists. And we thought it would be a great way to showcase island music. And so what we did is we found songs to place between each scene, and we cut them to about a minute in length. And the lights would never go off. We had two coat racks at the back, one for Rebecca and one for me, and it was dressed with all of our clothes for the whole act. And between each scene, this music would play, and we'd have a bit of a choreographed moment, but it was more as ourselves and not as our characters, and we would play and change right there on stage. So it was cool. The audience could see, you know, maybe the extra effort that it took to get into these, you know, costume pieces of that time, and it kind of stopped, you know, the lagging moments of, oh, we're doing an awkward scene change.
I mean, I saw Mary Walsh do a show here in Ottawa, and it was a one-woman show, and she would just change on stage too, and it was interesting to me in that, like, she would change, start the process of changing while in one character, And then as soon as she was dressed, she would just launch into the other character, which was really interesting. But given the type of wardrobe, if you're wearing 19th century female garb, that would be a little more difficult.
Yeah, it was. We really had to rehearse and be clever with how we were helping each other. You know, we really had to help dress each other depending on what we were getting into. And some costumes, obviously, we cheated a bit on, you know, maybe using snaps with the buttons on the outside, so we didn't actually have to physically button everything up, or, you know, there was ways that we had to get around it, or else we would be waiting 20 minutes between every scene. And some character switches were simply like, you know, just adding a cape and gloves, cape and gloves, you know, or those kind of simple changes to just mark that it was a new character.
So you mentioned that this wasn't a typical play with, you know, this narrative plot and everyone's happily ever after at the end. So what type of approach was it? Was it chronologic in the sense that you're moving forward? You said you sort of skipped around a little bit, but did it maintain some sort of chronology, or did you go thematically?
Yeah, we really linked it. I guess the process was interesting for Becca and I, being two writers, and she was in PEI and I was in Toronto when we wrote it. And we kind of decided that we would do our research and write just on our own and then come together and see what we had. And it was amazing. We never really picked the same subjects or people to write about, and we found links through all of them. You know, we might have been talking about Mercy Coles in one of the scenes, and then the next thing you know, in the next scene, we had Mercy Coles. And then, you know, we might have been talking about, you know, the love of George and Anne Brown, and then the next scene we had Anne reading a letter from George. So we were able to link it more that way than chronologically, I guess.
And the audience, she said sort of about the third scene, sort of audiences got it. And but I mean, as a performer, is that difficult? Obviously, once you sort of run it a few times, you're understanding that the audience is sort of generally picking this up around that point. Does that change the way you're performing in those early scenes?
Yeah, I mean, it really, I found it frustrating at the beginning. We put every effort into making it clear, you know, from even, you know, our first characters into our second characters would have English accents and be wearing, you know, scarves or pretending it was really cold outside, you know, and then we'd still have someone after like, oh, I thought you were the same people, which I was just, you know, after a while, I just tried to accept it and move on. But it really did make a difference. You could kind of tell, you know, we put a lot of effort really pronouncing things, really, you know, hitting over the head what our names were and things like that in the beginning to get people on board. And for the most part, I think once people got reading the articles and really looking at what they were coming to see before they sat down, they were fine.
Now, what were the audience reactions like, Lori? Obviously, I wonder how many people had known a lot about the Women Confederation, or at least of the time. And did people come up to and talk to you about it, saying that they'd never heard of these people? Or did they talk about the representation that you guys did with them? What was the audience comments like?
We had a really strong positive reaction from the show for different manners, creatively. I know with a lot of the grants going out, there was a lot of debate on the island this summer about the money spent into, you know, different projects for these celebrations. And we did have a lot of reaction from people that they were pleased that we put the money towards something that was more of a legacy project. So it was something that we built from scratch. We were able to employ a lot of people from the island or promote people from the island or different artists, maybe not even from the island, and showcase work. So make that money go further and the project accessible. But then in the other way, like you were saying about the, you know, research wise, the reaction was interesting. Some people never knew anything about Confederation. Some people, obviously the theme was going around the island. We had things that were, you know, more heard of about, you know, there was a circus going on PEI, which people heard or read in a lot of different articles. Mm-hmm. But then we had people like a demographic of older women when it came to our show. And we have a scene where one of the servants wants to be a teacher. And that's a problem for one of the young women living in the house. And they get into, you know, big debacle about that. And the women in the audience gave us like a standing round of applause at the end of the scene, and they were just so fiercely proud. And it was a night that we actually only had these five women in the audience. It was just them.
Wow.
And so it was interesting to see how proud they were of that. And you know, it just really kept connecting with me, depending on different audiences, how young Canada is and how some of these issues, depending on our demographic, you know, we're pretty fresh still. Mm-hmm.
In putting the show together, I mean, you talk about how that's pretty cool to have such a strong reaction like that. Did you have an audience in mind while you were putting this thing together?
We definitely catered to an island audience, which I know sounds a bit random. You know, how could you cater to a specifically island audience? But we kind of knew the humor, or we thought we knew the humor of who we were catering towards, and wanting to make some local references throughout to get the, you know, the kind of Anne of Green Gables ha ha in there. you know, tipping our hat to those. At the same time, we knew for the theater that was picking us up, Watermark Theater in North Rustico, they actually have a great mix of local audience members who are pretty loyal, but also tourists who come in. So we didn't want it to be totally focused, you know, excluding those people. But I would say it was more for the island ins and outs. And we were very nervous on our first night. It was a free performance, and we had invited a bunch of friends and local artists and bribed them with free cookies and lemonade and come on out, you know. And we hadn't shown this to anyone. Rebecca and I directed and produced it as well, and did the set and everything except for the costumes and the stage management and the sound. So I think our team of, you know, five of us were the only ones who saw it. And Rebecca and I thought we were pretty clever, but got jitters the day of, and we're like, oh my God, what if nobody gets what we're saying? What if our research is awful? You know, and it happened to be lucky for us. We had the most welcoming, generous audience that we could have. And that, you know, credited towards that a lot of people knew us. So I don't know, you know, if it would be the same if it was a whole group of strangers, but they really, really enjoyed it. So we were happy about that.
Well, that's interesting that you didn't really have that much of an opportunity to test it in advance, which sort of makes me wonder about what the writing process was like. Because obviously, if you don't have that opportunity to go in front of an audience or to do it on several occasions with the opportunity to do some rewrites, what was that writing process like, particularly in terms of accuracy and trying to get finding the voice of these women and ensuring that it is reflective of who they were?
Yeah, it was a really interesting process. It came down to money, really, in the end.
It always does.
Yeah, we got this grant. I mean, I was told that a million times in theater school, you know, you'll never have enough time. It'll always be about money. And I was, you know, the stupid one who's like, no, it'll never be about money. It'll never be about that. I'll have all the time in the world. And it came down to money, and I hate those words. But
it was the optimism there, Lori. It's a good optimism. You know, yeah, you haven't been squashed by the world and the realities of the world yet. That's good.
Thank you, Aaron. So we had on our timeline about a month in January to do research, which is
that's not a lot of time.
No. I mean, we did this pretty much full time round the clock, but it still was not a lot of time. You know, you can get absorbed in a massive novel, and I'm not, you know, a big reader. So that was, you know, for the first time ever, I spent a lot of time at the library, and I was very proud of myself. Anyway, we started writing in February. We needed to, in order to get the drafts and double check our research that we were including. By March, we had our full first draft. But at that point, we started doing some more rewrites. And in April, we started, you know, getting all the set stuff together. And May, we were rehearsing. So it was a really quick, you know, it went really from research to writing. And then we almost skipped over, you know, getting in depth with that, because we had to do the logisticals, like, you know, well, does this scene work, you know, in comparison to the other scenes? You know, what's our space that we're performing in? It's just us two women. You know, do we have enough of this person versus that person? You know, kind of stuff. And so we rehearsed for 3 weeks, or 2.5 weeks, and we did our first two performances. But then lucky enough, when we were brought on with Watermark, part of that contract was that while we were performing in June, we worked with a dramaturge, and that person was Darcy Evans from Ontario. And that was an amazing experience because we really got to sit down and look at our historical research, but also just, you know, does this make sense? You know, will people be totally lost here? You know, so it was nice. It was a nice treat.
What type of sources were you looking at? You mentioned you get lost in a novel. Was it primarily a fictionalized version of the Charlottetown Conference, or were you going to the more scholarly stuff?
It was a mix of everything. I mean, we were looking at, we really wanted to find journals or sources from these women, and it was really disappointing because we found it very hard to find, you know, firsthand information. We really wanted the juicy bits, which was, you know,
scandal.
We were interested in Confederation Conference and everything, blah, blah. We wanted the juicy bits, and I think we were kind of disappointed initially that, you know, obviously no one was tweeting then or doing their Facebook drama blogs or anything. So
there's no TMZ PI in 1864.
No. Come on. Yeah. So, but we were able to, find some journal stuff, but also, you know, read into information about people who didn't attend conference, but were around that time. Like we found journals from other women or, you know, noting about women or people at that time or scenarios. And so we were able to kind of mix fact with fiction. And I'd like to joke about it that when we started, our kind of aim would be to write Titanic, basically. You know, how when, you know, I remember when I saw Titanic, the movie, I was like, amazing, like, this happened, blah, blah, blah. I didn't really realize till I get older, you know, most of that was untrue. But this, you know, the scenario was true. So we had some liberties to be able to mix, you know, things that really did happen and then have some fun and liberty and not just be writing facts down.
Well, how do you find the balance between those two things? Because obviously the show is to be entertaining. I mean, there's an audience there that has come out and wants to see a show. But, you know, you are dealing with an event that actually happened and with people who actually existed and who were at that event. So how, what was the process like for you trying to find the balance between those two elements, which, let's be honest, at times those two things can be in conflict with each other?
Yeah, it was difficult. I mean, the lucky thing with the two of us is once we started reading each other's work, you know, you could easily find the inconsistencies, you know, if we were both taking creative liberties and the character was going in an untrue place on either side, it would keep us in check, you know, it would really, yeah, I guess keep us in check is the best way to say it. The other thing is we would often, or maybe not Rebecca, but definitely myself, I would find myself in trouble with modern day speech a lot of the time. And that was maybe the most difficult in writing it, that I maybe wasn't an expert on how people talked at that time and would end up saying things that really, when we went to go visit it, it was like, oh, like, you know, she probably wouldn't, you know, as a woman of that time in class, say the word damn, or, you know, like she, or maybe she would, or, you know, or saying something like bloody, you know, bloody hell is like a pretty, you know, curse word to say maybe at that time for some of those women, you know. So it was really just making sure that we didn't make it sound like we were trying to speak a way that we couldn't write, but then not sounding like ourselves today.
But again, that's part of sort of maintaining your audience as well. I mean, you don't want to go too deep into historical vocabulary, because then you can lose an audience that way too.
I know. I think the funniest thing was, I don't know if I have a good example of it, but on our first night, I have this friend of my mom's, and she's a lovely woman, and she's often correcting me in the, you know, so-and-so and I, or me and so-and-so, you know, all those ways of correctly speaking that I can't even give you an example because, you know, I may say
the example might be wrong, and then you're
correct. Yeah. Too nervous, I'm on the spot. But, you know, afterwards, she had collected a bunch of those examples, you know, is it cups full of tea or tea in my cup, or, you know, and I was like, I don't know. Well, the character says it like that. Like, that's just the way that they say it, you know. But, you know, there's different people always keeping us in check. But I think you're right. Like, if we had really gone into not Shakespearean, obviously that's way before, but that kind of, you know, what people would categorize as that sort of speech, we probably would have lost a lot of our audience's attention. I mean, as it was, I think some of it was probably a bit over people's heads. Even what we were wearing was a bit over people's heads. I mean, we came out just in our hoop skirts and corsets at one point, shocked some people.
Did you find that looking at some of the diaries and reading their actual words helped to contextualize and to put it all together for you?
Definitely. Yeah, it definitely did. I mean, after, you know, you start reading for 12 hours in a day, you know, researching, you start to almost speak like that. I know a couple times, you know, my boyfriend would be home and reading something with me and I'd start to talk, you know, be like, oh my God, I'm talking like one of the people in this book, like, wah! So it does help, but, you know, you can still be self-conscious about it, that when you're writing that you're not being at all accurate. So it really felt good when Rebecca and I started working together to see that we'd found a common ground.
And did you have anybody else in that process to sort of bounce stuff off of? And I'll think specifically of someone who has studied the conference to sort of, you know, run stuff by them just to make sure you're on the right track?
No, we did have people definitely to run it by. I mean, I definitely was thankful for the help of Aaron. I went up to visit Aaron and Megan. Philip and I went to go visit them and definitely ran some things by him. I knew he was a history whiz, and, you know, we had some different people surrounding us who were quite knowledgeable. We had some people on PEI, actually, some historians, Catherine Hennessy, I believe, and she wrote a book about the PEI conference and Quebec conference, and Rebecca, I believe, was in touch with her, and so we were kind of keeping in check on that, and then more artistically, kind of got together with some of our actor friends, and we're always reading drafts, and having people who didn't know anything at all about conference was also helpful, because they could say, I have no idea what that is. And we knew that most of our audience wouldn't have come to see the show having sat down and done a bunch of research. So we wanted them to be able to understand at the same time.
Sorry, just who's this Megan, Aaron? I don't know who this person is.
Oh, sorry. For Sean's benefit and for our listeners, Megan is the woman to whom I will soon be related to by marriage.
Oh, okay.
Hopefully that helps.
Oh, thank you.
Okay, yeah, no problem. Sure, I mean, okay. I know that you forget her name every so often.
Yeah, I know, that's very helpful.
I'm sure she's going to love that little shout-out right now.
Sorry for putting you on the spot, Aaron.
Oh, no, that's quite all right, Lori. This is Sean. That's all him. That has nothing to do with you.
So you're putting together this show. You're going through. You're doing the history. You're taking some artistic license to this. I mean, without giving away too much of what the show is, I mean, what's the purpose of the show? Why did you want to do this? And what sort of message are you trying to convey by going back and telling the story?
That's a good question. The unfortunate, you know, initial answer to that question is that Rebecca and I wanted work for the winter. And this grant was specifically, you know, geared towards the topic of PEI conference and confederation. So we knew when we were, you know, making a proposal for the grant that it had to be about that. But the surprising answer, I think, for both of us was maybe that once we got into it, it didn't take us long at all to get rolling and really invested in the subject. And we knew right away that we wanted to focus on women of that time, because women rock.
So the grant itself wasn't devoted to women. It was devoted to the Charlottetown Conference?
That's right. They were giving away, and this particular grant was actually for a public arts installation. So many of them went to you know, people making a quilt to put you know, install publicly, or a statue or an art piece. And we kind of went out on a limb and said that we could publicly install a live performance of our piece. And they were really excited about that. And so we did, you know, propose ourselves that it would be about women. And we got really into that. And then it kind of just rolled into us wanting to, you know, show how proud we were to be Islanders. Obviously, you know, we came with some challenges when, you know, researching that PEI didn't even want to, you know, host the conference or, you know, so it really had some big roadblocks, you know, and I actually still find it funny whenever I see, you know, some publicity on the island or even Canadian wise now leading up to the 150 of Canada. But, you know, talking about, oh, it all started here. We're so proud. And, you know, I was just kind of giggling to myself, like, nobody wanted this. This wasn't our idea. But that being said, without kind of being dishonest in our piece, we wanted to focus on what we should be proud of. And part of that was we had actually found a letter from Margaret Gray Lord, or Artemis Lord, sorry, Margaret. We took some inserts from her letter and tagged them, bookend them at the beginning and end of our piece as a through line. We used her voice to say, you know, I've heard these stories, blah, blah, blah. And so we enter into these stories of these women and tag at the end, like, wouldn't, you know, how proud would our forefathers be if they could see how far ahead our little island has come, you know? And I think that rings true, whether it was through the stories that we shared or if our audience is just sitting there thinking of, you know what, yeah, we do have a lot to be proud of. And I think that was kind of our purpose.
So would you say then, would it be fair for me to gather based on that, that it's more of a celebratory piece?
Yeah, I would say. But there are moments where we really kind of maybe question, you know, we kind of try to mark on that we can't take credit for everything, or that there's still lots to change or lots of way, you know, things to do and progress to be made. It kind of leads us, you know, we have a lot more potential to make this piece grow even further. And I know with the 150th of Canada coming up, we have the option to really expand that outside of just the PEI theme, you know, really taking it in regards to Canadians, I guess.
So you have this show, you get your grants and you write it, everything's great. You go out to the island to perform this thing and you're out there for 3 months. First month you're in North Rustico and then you're sort of traveling around the island. What was the general reaction of folks out there?
I think people really liked it. It was really hard for us to promote our piece. Even when I'm talking to you, I find it really difficult, you know, without going into the scenes to share what it's about. And I think our downfall with, you know, our PR, you know, people hear, okay, you know, it's about Confederation, it's about women. They look in their photo like they're wearing clothes from an old time. You know, this is going to be boring. And it was really hard to maybe try to share that with people before they came. And one of the comments that we continuously got was how well we were able to be accurate with our research, but also make it modern and accessible, and that it was funny. And we didn't set out to make it a comedy at all, but it kind of turned out that way. We found that there was a lot of ourselves, Rebecca and I, in the piece. And we tried to really, you know, when you're watching TV shows now, like Downton Abbey or, you know, any of those period pieces, I think even, you know, if you're watching The Tudors or any of those shows, it's interesting to people watching them because, or at least for me, whenever I watch them, I find it interesting that the people are not as I would have expected people from the olden times to be. You know, they're just like me, but with different rules and regulations. And so I feel like that's how a lot of our audiences felt, that, you know, oh my God, these characters maybe are a little sassy or a little bit stupid or a little bit silly, or, you know, they're not necessarily what I would imagine someone from this time to be.
I think that's a really good point too, because oftentimes I think we forget that there's certain universal things to being a human being, mm-hmm. that, yeah. may not change over time. Those core things of, you know, people who are trying to, you know, find love and who want to have friends and have positive relationships, or, you know, I want to go eat. Like these, there's very universal things that don't necessarily change. So even if something happened 150 years ago, there is a way to connect it to our own lives.
Definitely. And you have to remember, you know, I always find it interesting, you know, my grandmother will say to me now, like, you know, it's such different times now. Everyone's so wild now, you know, it never would have been like that back in my day. And I have to disagree a lot of the time, because I think all of these things, you know, drinking's not more now than it was then. It's maybe even less now than it was then, you know. There were still, you know, men sleeping with men and women sleeping with women in that time. You know, we just didn't maybe hear about it, or maybe we did, but we didn't talk about it, you know. So, yeah, it was interesting to recognize that.
I think that's really interesting, too, because it's not so much that, like you say, that these things didn't happen, or that they happen more now. It's that we live in a more public world now than we used to. So something like this almost is putting a modern gaze, that public gaze, on something that existed in a world that was maybe more private.
And I think one of my favorite scenes that we did was one that I researched. I found an advertisement for a wife, and that kind of blew my mind, because I instantly just thought of, you know, those ads on Craigslist, you know, being like, I saw you, did you see me, you know, da da da. I forget, I don't know what they're called. What are they, like?
Missed connections.
Missed connections. Thank you.
Sean knows all about
they're
those.
They're so funny. And sorry, not to interrupt you, but Eric McDonald, will give him a shout out, because he did his MA here at the University of Ottawa. And one day, he was the person who someone was trying to reach out to on a missed connection. He was a TA in a class, and the missed connection was, and he's what, 6'4"?
Yeah, if that, or sorry, if not taller.
Yeah, and so it was like, oh, my real tall, and he's a bright redhead, redheaded TA in this course, you're so hot. Like, and he was on the missed connection, and it sort of became this story of some lore around the department, but...
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Well, so, I mean, you were mentioning it a little bit, Lori. If anyone takes a look at newspapers from back then, obviously in our inboxes, we're inundated with spam of this, that, and the other thing. And if you go to newspapers back in, say, around the 1860s, I've looked at it a little bit, and people are selling you every miracle cure you can think of. Apparently, you know, anything you take will cure this, that, or the other thing. So, I mean, in that regard, as you said, things don't really change. Just the medium in which they're delivered and the exact products change a little bit, though.
Yeah, I mean, like, I even found it more harsh than our ads today. Like, now it's like, you know, online dating or go on, you know, Craigslist, whatever. It's like, I'm looking for someone who likes the beach and blah, blah, blah. And this ad that I found was, like, specifically they had to be 5'4" or 5'5". And you couldn't have red or white hair. You were, you know, I would allow you to sometimes speak French. You know, you had to come with money. And it's like, it's a lot more harsh than today.
I'm sorry, what's the problem with all that? I'm sorry. Sounds great, doesn't it? I'm joking. Don't send me any letters. But I like that. I mean, the battle or the persecution of redheads existed in 1864, too.
You had to put that out there?
Naturally.
Oh, okay. Sean's defending himself, Laura, because I don't know if you've seen pictures of Mr. Graham here, but he himself is a redhead.
Oh, is he? Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's why he had to defend his himself and his
fellow
drinkers.
Well, I would never have brought it up before, Sean. I'm sorry.
Well, you know, I mean, you know, the way you just throw it out there so casually, it's a little jarring, I gotta say. Well, I mean, and especially, I mean, if you're from PEI, you'd think you'd have a little more redhead sensitivity than that.
Well, that's actually, you know, in that scene, we go on to make jokes about that. You know, one of the girls in the scene has red hair, and this letter is saying he won't accept redheads. And she goes on to say, you know what, like, red, people with red hair, I mean, like, there'll be people travel from far across the world sometime to come here to see girls with red hair, you know? Like, you know, getting in again those ha-ha end of Green Gables jokes, but...
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's a somewhat legendary story that I like to tell of a person who applied for a job with the federal government, looks like me, checked the I'm a visible minority box, went in for the interview. Guy said, you checked the invisible minority box. He said, I'm a redhead. Went through and then had a speech prepared about how redheads not only are minorities, but are also persecuted minorities.
Oh, my goodness.
Things like Pick a Ginger Day and all this, and redheaded stepchild and all these things. It's a somewhat legendary story that I very much enjoy, especially given that, I mean, if I believe we're trending downward in our numbers.
Yeah, I think that's what it is, isn't it? Yeah, it's the recessive gene is just starting to.
Yeah, it's just we're gonna be. I mean, it's 50-50 whether it's us or polar bears who are extinct first.
Well, so. Then you should get on that, John.
Yeah, I guess, but I have a buddy at softball who I play softball with, who's a redhead, and he's always talking about how his dream is to find a redhead woman to save the species. I guess I don't know.
Save the species.
But anyway, so back to the show. You mentioned earlier that you were trying to put in some island sensibilities into the show. Did audiences pick up on that? And were they appreciative of the fact that you tried to tailor it specifically to an island audience?
I think they were appreciative. I'm sure sometimes our humor, depending on our performance, maybe we got a little carried away in our own sick humor. But I think they were appreciated, and you could definitely tell when we had an island heavy audience or if we had a lot of tourists visiting. And sometimes, the tourists would laugh at the island stuff too, but there are different levels of island humor, I guess, in there.
Did you notice a change based on location as well?
Yeah, I mean, we had some lines that were a bit interchangeable. I mean, when we would go up west, we maybe, would change a line from, even the lads down east, know how to dress properly. Well, we would then switch it and, make it about the guys up west, to get an extra laugh or those kind of things. But I don't know if it was too directed at any kind of audience in the end.
Now, having spent the summer out there doing the show, and as I mentioned at the top of the show, there's all these celebrations going on right now for the 150th anniversary of the conference. I'm just wondering what your take is on how this thing is being commemorated and how you fit into this larger commemoration and celebration that's going on the island.
It's been an interesting summer. I was disappointed I didn't get out to sea very much because we were working on our own project. So I can't comment necessarily on too much that I've seen. I've just read a lot. And personally, I think any kind of celebration, I'm for it because I think celebrations are good, and it has to go deeper on what an artist, how can we take money from the government or use donations and things like that, and why are artists important? And so I feel like when Rebecca and I set out to do this play, it was important that it was our own work. It was important that we employed as many people as we could, and that we really took every penny as far as we could and reached as many different demographics as we could, which is why we had some free performances in there, which is why we, did our show for $20 instead of $40, our usual, show price, to access, let people access the show more easily. But on that note, I did hear of a lot of projects that revolved just to make, take a show that already existed in their season and, just make more costumes or, bigger lights or things like that. And it's a bit disappointing when there's money given to celebrate that it wasn't used for research or to share new things with people or to make a legacy project that was just kind of going down the drain for that 1 month or 2 months or 3 months. So I don't know. What do you think of the celebrations on the island?
Well, I mean, I thought they were, from what I saw, I thought they were well done. And I thought it wasn't as narrow as I thought it was going to be.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was going to be just, here's the conference, here's all it is. But it was really, it was more than that. And especially the stuff down by the waterfront seemed very much of a celebration of contemporary PEI as much as anything else. It was like, here's the diversity of the island, here's what we offer. And even at that, we were walking through the area and the band on stage, it definitely wasn't any sort of East Coast or Celtic music.
No, that was the neat thing. Sorry to interrupt you.
Yeah, no.
It was neat because I know that they, in the Celebration Zone, really focused on having themed weeks, I believe. And so, you know, every week for a good portion of the summer, they would have Alberta Week or BC Week, and they would bring in artists from there and showcase their music. So it really broadened more Canadian than just PEI or East Coast.
Well, even at that, like, we saw an Indian band playing, you know, Indian yeah. instruments. Like, it was, so it was really interesting in that respect, in that, I mean, and I could be wrong on this, but I don't know if PEI has a substantial Indian community, but I don't know.
I think you'd be reckless.
Yeah, so like, so it was really interesting to see them up there and as part of this celebration, because I think that my, you know, my Ontario centric view of what I thought this celebration would be fiddles and mussels.
Mussels.
Okay.
Right? Yeah. So I'm sitting there thinking, all right, there's just going to be mussels all over the place, a bunch of Celtic music, and we're going to drink East Coast beer. But it was much. But it was a lot more than that.
Sean, that's what we do all the time. We had to mix it up.
Oh, okay. I understand that. I understand.
No, so I'd say the one complication, if any, because I actually thought the summer was a success, and I know they're actually continuing into celebrations right up until this New Year's. They're wrapping them up in Summerside, I think. But if I heard anything from some artists, was that there was almost too much on the island. As you mentioned earlier when I was speaking to you, you know, though PEI is not as small as you thought it was, it's still pretty small. Mm-hmm. And there was so much to do this summer for locals and tourists. But we depend a lot on our locals for things that are happening in the summer. And there was not enough time to go see everything. And though there were a lot of grants for artists to make work, there was also a lot of events put on by the government or private funding that was free for the public. So we almost didn't have audiences because we had competition with people, with events down in the Celebration Zone that were free. There was lots of amazing artists from around Canada who are coming and playing these massive free concerts. And so, you know, why would you pay money if you can go do something for free? Or if you had no time on your schedule, like, how can you fit everything in? So it was almost too much awesome in one summer.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we sort of ran into that a little bit in that, I mean, we were there for 5 or 6 days or whatever it was, and we were there to play golf, in all fairness. So we didn't really look for a lot of these things, but, you know, when sort of going through what can we do, there were sort of all these things that we had thought in advance, so we want to do this, 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 and this, and then we get there, and oh, there's all these other things as well. And, you know, even if you're there for a week and you're not playing golf, I mean, it would have been very difficult to fit all that stuff in. So I can see what you're saying. And yeah, I mean, there's a benefit to doing things for free. But like you say, if it's competing against stuff that you have to buy a ticket for, that really puts that thing in a disadvantage if it's all part of the same thing.
Hmm. I won't complain. I like going to free things too. So as a...
And you're talking to two people who have no money.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. So. Oh, you can include myself in that. No, it was a challenge to make everything. And I know everyone who was organizing something really wanted to make their event accessible. Like, it really was generous that way, that everyone wanted people to attend, not so that their thing could make money, but so that, you know, everyone could really participate in the celebrations, which was really cool.
So is this work that you've done, obviously you've gone through, you've done your run through the summer, but based on how you were talking, that's not the end for this project?
I don't think it's the end. I mean, we put so much work into it, and don't get me wrong, at the end of the summer, August 2nd, Rebecca and I respectively, you know, put away our costumes and stuff and said, all right, see you in a bit. Like, we both needed a big breather. And so for the last month and a half, I haven't even thought about the show until I thought about doing this podcast with you guys. And I just kind of put it in the back burner because we needed a break. But now we're just starting conversation about, now that we have a piece and we've had time to let it settle, what next? I mean, we're pretty lucky that we have, you know, all of our costumes, set, script, in French and in English, ready to go. And we do know, obviously, with the 150th anniversary of Canada, that there's some opportunity there, like I said, to take it out of PEI. I'm not sure if the piece, how well it would resonate all the time if it wasn't geared towards a specific Canadian celebration. I think its demographic would be quite a bit smaller. Like, it's interesting. It's a fun piece, but definitely when you have a reason to put it on, it draws a bigger crowd, I think.
Well, the governments right across the board, federal, municipal, provincial, they've all been putting money into promoting the 150th of Confederation. And so it's one of those things that it's just because it's no longer going to be the 150th of the Charlottetown Conference this year. There's definitely room for more performances later on, leading up even to 2017 for the 150th of 1867. Obviously, because it was a long, drawn-out process. It wasn't as though it was they met in Charlottetown, Quebec, and then, boom, we had Confederation. We had, yeah, Canada, boom, right? That was there, perfect. So, yeah, I think there's definitely room for you guys to take it across the country and to show it off. And who knows, maybe try to get it here in Ottawa at the NAC, something like that, just because, and even if it's one of those things that if you have to stretch it out a little bit, you got time.
Yeah, and that's the beauty. I mean, rarely am I usually this prepared for an event that's coming up. It's a one thing, you know, the 150th MPI set us up that we've done the research and we've done the writing, and even if we have to go back to that and tweak and go more in depth, but because the big celebrations aren't, you know, for three more years, we really have the time even just this year to sit and focus and go visit people, go visit theaters, go visit schools and say, you know, this is what we have on the table. What's the interest like? So, yeah.
Yeah, and I know, I mean, in this city already there's banners for 2017.
Oh, yeah.
All over the city and you know, letting people know that something big is happening. So I would agree that there's probably definitely some legs on this yet. So the show is What to Wear to the Birth of a Nation. Lori, if people want more information on the show or to get in contact with you, how would they go about doing that?
We do have a Facebook page. If you look it up, What to Wear to the Birth of a Nation. But if Facebook is not something that you have, you can always drop me a line if you want some more information on that. And it's just lori-campbell@hotmail.com.
Okay, and we will link to that on the post on Active History. So anybody, if you want to get in contact or some more information, we'll link to all this. Just go to activehistory.ca. You'll find all the information there. Lori Campbell, actor, writer, thank you so much for doing this. We appreciate it.
Oh, thanks for having me on the show.
Oh, my pleasure. And the man, the myth, the legend, always a pleasure having you here.
Thanks for having me back again.
It's always good times. If you have any questions, comments for the podcast, historyslam@gmail.com. Twitter is @DrShawneeFever. And actually follow Aaron Boys 1 as well.
Give me a follow. Who knows? Maybe I might tweet out something interesting every now and then. Not like Dr. Shawnee Fever, but
once in a while.
Once in a while is good.
Yeah. And if you're out and you see Enrico Palazzo, please say hi for me.
Thanks for listening to the History Slam podcast. Be sure to check out Active History for more features, articles, and be sure to subscribe on iTunes.